Chapter 26, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. Tito and his communists are still on the march. People marching, marching, marching. All day and practically all night, people marching. That's what I remember most vividly about Belgrade. That, and incongruously enough, old women selling bunches of purple hyacinths on the street. The first evening, which was a Sunday, there was a surf of shuffling feet and droning voices along the side of our hotel, reminiscent of the Sunday evening in Salonika. Thousands of Yugoslavians were tramping shoulder to shoulder and thigh to thigh along Belgrade's main drag. I hung out of the window staring at them. Were all the various nationalities of Yugoslavia marching there? Were there Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes? There are 8 million Serbs in Yugoslavia, 4 million Croats, and 1.25 million Slovenes. Did they march in preparation to their in proportion to their numbers? And how about the Hungarians, Germans, Romanians, and Albanians who still live within the boundaries of Yugoslavia? Did they parade too? This, though, was not an organized parade. It was simply, as so people told me, an old Slavic custom, but it is the only unorganized movement, I am sure, in Yugoslavia. The next day, and the day after, the marching was definitely under orders. Almost any hour, I could see gray-clad columns of soldiers stepping smartly to the music of their own raised voices in both the streets and sidewalks. Were they singing, I wondered, that favorite partisan song, Tito, you are us, we are you? The sight and sound of them was alarming, but nothing like so alarming as the sight and sound of the youth brigades when they appeared in the afternoons to put on their show. Evidently, they were in school in the morning, for it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when they charged toward our hotel, shouldered shovels, pickaxes, and electric drills, and fell to tearing up the street. For some reason, no one on the commission could understand, and no Yugoslav explained to us, the authorities were digging up, or rather having dug up, an exceedingly wide and handsome avenue by our hotel. By 5 o'clock most mornings, and I cross my heart, by 4:30 other mornings, drills begin to drill, pickaxes to pick, trucks to truck, and steam shovels to shovel. One morning, it was barely day when I got up and looked out to see if men were really working at that hour, or were they pixies? They were men, and they continued to work until dark, but in the afternoon their number was augmented by the youth brigades. A long way off, I could hear the children coming, their heads thrown back and their throats wide open in song. They marched toward a small shack directly across the street from the hotel. Stopping there only long enough to snatch up implements of demolition, they flung themselves upon the paving stones of the avenue. Never have I seen children work so madly. They formed lines between those who were digging up cobblestones and those who were heaving them into trucks, and passed the cobblestones along them as gaily as if they were biscuits. Why the trucks didn't move up to those who were digging, and thus do away with the necessity of handling the cobblestones from child to child, I couldn't understand. But then there was so much I couldn't understand in Yugoslavia. These children are part of the National Yugoslav Youth Movement known as USOAO. Almost all the young belong to it. A membership is supposed to be voluntary, but those who refuse to join have their food rations cut so dangerously low they, quote-unquote, voluntarily join. The president and general secretary are, of course, communist, and many of the other leaders, too. The youth movement was holding an exhibition in the old palace of the brother of the former king during our stay in Belgrade, and I went, but I didn't enjoy myself. I continued to be frightened. Mrs. John M. Cabot, I unfortunately persisted in calling her Mrs. Lodge, the wife of the United States Charge d'Affaires in Belgrade, went with me and kindly interpreted the French of the young man guide who showed us around. Mrs. Cabot didn't always catch what he said, and I didn't always catch what Mrs. Cabot said, for during our entire visit, a gramophone blared Russian music loud enough to deafen us. The guide announced proudly it was from a recent Russian movie. In addition to Russian music, there were red stars and hammers and sickles all over the place, and enormous photographs of Stalin hung, as usual, side by side with those of Tito. Just before going to the exhibition, I had my nails done in a beauty parlor, and there, too, I faced Stalin with Tito above the manicuring table. Over acres of palace walls were spread huge blown-up pictures of the projects accomplished by the members of the organization during the past year and statistics of the number of hours, quote-unquote, given. One statistic pointed out that without pay, the Yugoslav youths had donated 5,700,000 days of work in the last 3 months. Most of the pictures were of young boys and girls working on the railroad, that is, the youth railroad, that is being built for 147 mountainous miles through the coal mining section of Bosnia with only youth labor. One poster proclaimed that in just 6 months, 60,000 young people had completed 92 miles of road. The idea of having young men and women do this railroad construction job was born in the spring of 1945, when the Yugoslav government announced it had no money to finish the road, and the leaders of the youth movement said their members would complete, free of charge, a 55-mile stretch. Naturally, the job was turned over to them, and they not only finished these 55 miles, but did 37 more. It has been estimated it would have cost the Yugoslav government $12 million in wages alone to have done this job. The boys and girls came from all over Yugoslavia to give a minimum stint of 2 months' labor, and they were joined by starry-eyed youngsters from 15 foreign nations, including the United States. They came like crusaders searching for the Holy Grail. The railroad had become a religion. The foreigners had their expenses paid while in Yugoslavia, but they worked, of course, for nothing. Most of the pictures of the exhibition showed the young swinging pickaxes, pushing shovels, laying rails, driving spikes, and during the leisure periods that followed 6 back-breaking hours of work, singing songs and listening to lectures, playing competitive games and reading books. Besides the USAOJ, or more correctly, perhaps as a special section of it, there were communist troopers belonging to the strictly communist youth organization, KOJ. Though I saw many photographs at the exhibition of communist leaders, I never got clearly in my mind whether they were the troopers. I suspect, though they were, for they were exceptionally good-looking, and I have read that they are picked and favored defenders of the regime, chosen for their physique, vigor, and devotion. Their number is estimated to run into the tens of thousands. The secret police are also as countless as the leaves on a tree. No one seems to know whether there are 50,000 or 150,000, but there are enough of them to be practically everywhere at every hour. They keep a characteristica, personal record, of every citizen. According to R.H. Markham, who, after 30 years in the Balkans, many of them as correspondent of the Christian Science Monitor, has written a must book on Yugoslavia called Tito's Imperial Communism. The secret police tries to watch every home and office, to follow every overt act and expression of opinion. Neither letters, telephone conversations, nor telegraph messages are beyond its vigilant eyes. It watches all movements of train or bus, listens to sermons and masses, notes who dares consort with foreigners, determines what must be said in speeches. Jobs depend upon its appraisal. Food cards are distributed according to its recommendation. Rooms are rented or evaluated at its commands. Entrance to the university depends upon its secret reports. It repairs and suppresses popular demonstrations, arranges slogans which the people must shout. It sends youth off to voluntary labor service. It sits in the restaurants, imbibes at bars, talks politics at the coffee houses, loiters in the marketplace, pursuing its victims. Enter the remotest village and it may ask why you are there. Mingle with the throngs in the busiest boulevards and you may be under its eyes. We of the commission had an example of its vigilance. A Yugoslav woman came to our hotel to call on an old friend, Mrs. Pat Foltergill, a member of the British delegation. She went up to the desk and asked the clerk for Mrs. Foltergill, but instead of giving her the information, he asked, "Who are you? Where do you live? Why do you want to see her?" Before the woman could answer the barrage of questions, Mrs. Foltergill fortunately came into the lobby and overheard them. As a member of the British consulate staff at Skopje, she is familiar with the methods of Yugoslavia's secret police and realized at once that the woman was in danger. Swiftly, she moved to the desk and she said to her friend, "Go quickly. Don't stop to say a word." As the woman started out of the hotel, the clerk stepped from behind the desk to follow her. "No, you don't," cried Mrs. Foltergill, and dashed to the door and stood in front of it, her arms outspread. The clerk hesitated. Mrs. Foltergill was a member of the commission for which the government had reserved the best rooms, had supplied the hotel kitchen with eggs and extra food delicacies, was given a buffet supper at a mountain resort. Could he thrust her aside like an ordinary person? Evidently he thought not, for he returned to his desk. The Yugoslav woman got away, at least for that moment. No doubt the ubiquitous police had her located before the day was out and arrested her as soon as the commission left Belgrade. It is not safe for a Yugoslav to associate with a quote-unquote foreigner unless he has been designated to do so by the government. The wife of a member of our embassy told me she was unable to pay the rent for her house to the Yugoslav woman who owned it, for the Yugoslav was afraid to be seen speaking to her. And another American, also connected with the embassy, said she had to stop giving picture magazines to a young girl who lived nearby because her family sent word the gift might get them into trouble. I went to several parties in Belgrade, but I never met any Yugoslavs other than those attached as liaison officers to the commission. If the liaison officers had wives or daughters or quote-unquote girlfriends, they kept them at home. And I never heard of a member of the commission who enjoyed any female Yugoslav companionship. In Sofia, where the secret police is cut out of the same cloth as the Yugoslav police, one young delegate, unattached by either wife or fiancé, grew lonely one evening and most shyly, he thought, picked up a Bulgarian girl near his hotel. Furtively, he slipped her up into his room. But no sooner had he reached it than the telephone rang and a male voice said, "Good evening, Monsieur dot dot dot. This is blank of the Sofia police. I just thought you'd like to know that the girl you have in your room has not been checked lately for venereal disease." Naturally, the delegate lost all interest in the girl, and not because of the danger of venereal disease. He knew it, he had tarred her with the feathers of foreign collaboration. The police would hop on her like a dog on a rabbit as soon as she reappeared on the street and make life a living hell for her. No delegate, so far as I know, cared to take such a chance in Belgrade. Arrests, tortures, and execution go on almost nightly in Belgrade. Even while we were there, the quote-unquote Black Maria continued to roll. An official, whose name perhaps it is not best to mention, told me at a cocktail party one afternoon that he had watched men and women being brought in to the headquarters of the secret police, still generally called OZNA, though officially it is now UDB, State Security Administration, practically all night long. Quote, "I stood at the window of an apartment within seeing distance of the police headquarters," the official said, "from 11 o'clock in the evening until 4 o'clock in the morning and watched the vans come in. At 3 o'clock, I lost my dinner, but returned to my post, and I personally counted 1,400 souls. No, I protested. They are in the basement of the headquarters now, and God knows how long they will stay there. This morning I saw them shoving their shoes up through the grill work in the pavement, trying to dry them in the sun. The basement has water in it, you know, and is bitter cold. The head of the secret police in Yugoslavia is Alexander Rankovic, a former tailor whom I did not meet, thank goodness, but from those who did, I gleaned he is bitter, sly, nasty, cruel, and ruthless. It is Marshal Josip Broz Tito, though, who is the real power in Yugoslavia, and he rules Yugoslavia with almost as much sureness and confidence as Stalin rules Russia. But that, of course, is only because Stalin trusts him so completely. He is Stalin's Yugoslavian ego. He spoke to a joint session of both councils of the People's Assembly the third day after the commission arrived in Belgrade and created considerable excitement. Though most of us attached to the commission didn't understand what he said until in the evening when we obtained translations of the speech, we knew it was defiant and bitter in tone, especially toward the United States. It is, of course, too long to quote here, but one section typifies so clearly his inimical attitude toward our Western democracies as compared to his devotion to Russia. I feel I must give it. Quote, "With incredible persistence, the Western reactionaries are slandering the Soviet Union, asserting that it has allegedly put its hand of influence on small countries in Eastern Europe, among which is Yugoslavia," he cried. "On the other hand, they slander Yugoslavia, asserting it to be an ordinary satellite. Yes, Yugoslavia and other countries of the East are going together with the Soviet Union just because they know it does not threaten their independence." At this point, there was a long applause. Then Tito declared, "We have continued to go together with the Soviet Union following the war because we are deeply convinced that the Soviet Union is the only country from all the great Allied forces which has understanding of our sufferings and of our sacrifices during the Great Liberation War." Here there were more hand clappings and murmurs of approval. "We and the rest of the small countries of Eastern Europe are going together with the Soviet Union," he reiterated, "because we are convinced that of all the Allied small and big countries, the Soviet Union is the only one which is fighting consistently for strengthening peace in the world, which is so necessary to the peoples." Again there was applause, even longer than before. "We are going with the Soviet Union because we hear from the Soviet Union always voices of peace," he shouted, "and this corresponds to our tendencies, while from the West we hear only about the atomic bomb and the threatenings of war." The applause grew more vigorous. "We see how England and America, as well as some other countries, are engaging themselves in Greece and Indonesia, China, and so forth, in suppressing people's freedom and democratic rights. We see the American imperialists are constantly threatening with war countries which do not want to resignate themselves to their financial and imperialistic dictature." Later in the speech, Tito waxed very wrathful over the loan of wheat which he had requested from the United States and not received. "Comrades, men and women," he yelled, "I would like to say here several words on that, I could almost say hateful, campaign, which is being carried on just now in some Western countries against Yugoslavia. The subject is wheat. It is said in that press that Yugoslavia is threatened with catastrophic famine, that Yugoslavia exports its wheat and corn, and the people are hungry, that Yugoslavia had asked from America 200,000 tons of wheat and even from England to prevent this tragedy which is awaiting our people. This is malicious campaign. This malicious campaign is clear, and its tendentiousness is seen which is to harm our country. On one hand, they refuse to send aid to our country, and on the other hand, they cry and lament over the difficult conditions in our country and over the impending of catastrophe. There was considerable appreciative laughter at this sarcasm, and then Tito cried. "What is it, in fact, comrades? Comrades, the Yugoslav government, that is, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, has asked through its assistant minister from the American Chargé d'Affaires to inform the American government on the true condition and communicate that in Yugoslavia, need is indeed felt for assistance in bread, because we had 2 years of drought. They have turned this step of ours into propaganda that we have fallen upon our knees, that the Yugoslav government is not capable, that it has brought the people to the edge of perdition by this desiring to shake our prestige abroad and to prove that Yugoslavia is not a consolidated and solid state, and that if we permit, in one word, they would be our tutors, and they will give us 200,000 tons of wheat, and we, comrades, would have a tutor." The accusation received tremendous applause, and one voice shouted, "Down with imperialism!" There was a great deal more, I'm sorry to say, along the same line. Marshal Tito was enjoying himself. He likes to make speeches. He likes to whip an audience into a frenzy, and he likes to tell stories. He is a commanding figure on the platform, or anywhere else for that matter. On public occasions, he wears a dark blue and gold uniform, embroidered on both sleeves with the marshal's emblem, which he designed himself. He is big and heavy-set and resembles Göring amazingly. When I first came into Yugoslavia and saw his pictures with Stalin's in all the windows of Nish, I wondered why the Yugoslavs were so fond of old photographs of their former Nazi leader. Fortunately, I didn't mention my confusion to my traveling companions. I'm sure they would never have let me hear the last of it. Tito's early history is cloudy, but the best authorities, Mr. Markham is my favorite here and always, believe he was a former Croatian worker from the town of Klanjats near Zagreb. They point to his green eyes, which are typically Croatian. And they know that he spent many years in Moscow, learning his communist lines so well that there is little danger of his fumbling them, that he married a Russian wife, and that he recruited Yugoslavia to fight for Russia in the Spanish Revolution. Since 1941, the details of his life are fuller and clearer, for it was in the late summer of that year that he leaped into prominence as the leader of the communist partisans in Yugoslavia, fighting the Germans. It is interesting to note, though, that he and his partisans did not leap until Hitler struck against Russia, and the word came down from Moscow that now was the time for all good communists to come to the aid of Mother Russia. The message was late as far as struggling Yugoslavia was concerned. 5 months before, on March 27, 1941, with no country actively opposing the all-powerful Nazi army except weakened England, Yugoslavia had taken her stand on the side of the Allies. It was actually a group of Serbian officers in the Yugoslav army who overthrew the pro-Hitler Yugoslav government, created an anti-Nazi regime, and made the declaration of war on Germany. The Serbs were enthusiastically supported in this move by the Slovenes, but the Croats knew nothing about it until it was done, and then they did not favor it. It was a bold and noble gesture, but futile. In 12 ghastly days, Yugoslavia was prostrate beneath the crooked cross of the swastika. Nevertheless, Yugoslavia continued the struggle by the 1st of May. Mikhailovic, a colonel in the regular Yugoslav army, was in the mountains gathering together his Chetniks. Chetniks is an old Balkan term for bandits who fight against foreign oppressors, and immediately began to harass the Nazis. But Tito and the communist partisans were not fighting anybody those days. They were the only group in Serbia and Slovenia who had no part in the early resistance movement. They were aligned with Russia, and Russia in the spring of 1941 was on the friendliest terms with fascist Germany. Yet Tito was ready. He, like Stalin and a great many other world leaders, believed that sooner or later Hitler would swing his armies toward red soil, and when that happened, Tito and his partisans would move to the attack. His plans for campaigning were complete. His contacts with communists in the Yugoslav army were made, and his cells well organized and alert. Hitler attacked Russia on June 22, 1941, and instantly Tito and the partisans jumped into action. They took possession of towns in western Serbia where they already had cells. They unfurled red flags, they unleashed communist secret police upon anti-communists, and they killed Serbs. Indeed, they killed many more Serbs than they killed Germans. The first shots of the Civil War that was to tear Yugoslavia into bloody shreds had been fired. Once in the early days of the struggle, Mihailovic and Tito met to see if they could work out an armistice, but naturally it failed. Tito insisted on maintaining an independent army in an independent state in Yugoslavia. This is exactly what the guerrilla leader Marcos is doing in northern Greece, and Mihailovic said no. As a member of the duly elected government of Yugoslavia and a colonel in the regular army, Mihailovic insisted that all guerrilla forces be under one command, his own. Long before the rest of the world had the scales of ignorance pulled from its dreamy eyes, Mihailovic understood that Tito's aim was not to conquer Germans, but to conquer Serbs and impose a communist regime on Yugoslavia. On the other hand, Mihailovic's aim was to save Serbia and her 8 million peasants from communism. So the civil war mounted in agony and fury side by side with the Yugoslav Nazi war. Sometimes the Chetniks fought Germans, sometimes the communist partisans fought Germans, but always they fought each other. After a year of ghastly carnage, Tito felt so sure of himself and his communist following that he formed an independent Yugoslav government in the west central city of Bibac, and so proclaimed to the world that he was through with the old government of Yugoslavia. The new regime consisted of a national council, the Anti-Fascist Council of National Liberation of Yugoslavia, known by the initials AVNOJ, an army of liberation and a central committee. Like all communist governments of which I have read and heard, AVNOJ announced only the highest aims: pure democracy, the inviolability of private property, no revolutionary social changes, no coercion, good jobs for fighters, and national rights for all the people of Yugoslavia. Many people lured by this bait swarmed in Tito's movement, but by the end of the year of the next year, approximately 140 delegates of AVNOJ met to consolidate their position. They elevated Tito to Marshal of Yugoslavia and made him head of all Yugoslavia's armed forces, and they denounced Mihailovic as a vile traitor. It is not shocking that Tito's hand-picked delegates should have denounced Mihailovic as a traitor. After all, he was the biggest stumbling block in Tito's path to absolute power. But what is shocking is that England and we in the United States, though I'm sure we were more reluctant about it, should have denounced him too. Churchill, as everybody knows, made the decision, after sending Major Jim Deacon, a sincere British officer, to make a personal investigation, Churchill cast England's lot with Tito and persuaded us to do likewise. The Major arrived in Yugoslavia when the Germans were making a vicious drive against the partisans, and, with his own eyes, he saw the partisans, though retreating, battle back with fury. He was impressed. Here were people who were not only fighting the enemy, but who fought with a fanatical zeal. What he didn't understand, of course, was why the partisans were fighting the Germans. There were times, naturally, when Tito had to fight the Nazis to keep a free area in which his partisan government could operate. And then, too, Stalin wanted him to fight Germans. They were the fascist enemy and had to be defeated before communism could be safe. Also, I must say for Major Deacon, though it hurts me, for I am really very bitter toward him, he saw Mihailovich's Chetniks molesting the partisans while they were retreating for their lives before the Germans. This spectacle of Yugoslavs fighting their brother Yugoslavs and thereby assisting the Germans to defeat them horrified him. He considered it collaborations with the enemy, and in a sense it was. But who was responsible for this internecine strife? Tito, of course. It was Tito who fought Serbs from the very day they had begun to fight. It was Tito who made Yugoslavia impotent against the enemy, who sabotaged the war effort which Mihailovich and his Serbs and Slovenes wanted so desperately to make. The major didn't recognize this, though, and he reported in favor of Tito, and we all know the end of the story. The sad, sad story. The Russians finally swept into Yugoslavia, and they swept their tool, Tito, into Belgrade. And there he struts and fulminates now in totalitarian power, a grave and frightening menace to the peace of the world. End of chapter 26.